From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. You met Liberia's Assistant Minister for Information in May. He's Sacramento man, Gabriel Williams. Well, he's back home for a quick vacation, and we'll catch up with him today on Insight. Also today, a short play called Sex Talk is at Sacramento State this weekend. The cast members, one of whom is the playwright, will join us. And the author of Angry Black White Boy, Adam Mansbach's book, is a satire about a white boy who's filled with rage toward white America. Adam Mansbach is in town for a panel discussion tonight at the Crocker Art Museum. First the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the play Sex Talk runs this weekend at Sacramento State. The playwright and the show's cast will join us. Also, novelist and journalist Adam Mansbach is best known for the book Angry Black White Boy. It's a satire about race, whiteness, and hip-hop. He's in town for a panel discussion tonight at the Crocker Art Museum. First, Sacramento man Gabriel Williams is back home for a few days' break from his job as Assistant Minister for Information for the Government of Liberia. We first met him in May on Insight on the eve of his departure for Monrovia. Gabriel, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. It's my pleasure to be here.
How did you manage to get a few days off from your work in Liberia to visit your family?
Well, I've been out here in the United States for the past 2 weeks. As a member of the official delegation of the Liberian president to the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly, which she addressed last week.
Well, that's a big deal. That must have been exciting for you.
Indeed. I mean, it was just amazing being among these various heads of state and government from around the world.
And tell us what Liberia's president, that's Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, what did she say to the United Nations General Assembly?
Well, many things. As you may know, Liberia is a founding member of the United Nations, and Liberia actually produced the first female president of the UN General Assembly. So during her address to the General Assembly, which is a maiden one, this is her first time, as you know, she was inaugurated in January 2006. So this was her first address. So she used the opportunity to thank the United Nations and the international community for all of the involvement that have made, that have brought about recovery and sustainable peace in Liberia, that also enabled the Liberian people to hold a very peaceful election that produced the first woman president in Africa. And then she also touched on a number of things, including the need to reform the United Nations General Assembly, to broaden the Security Council, to allow for developing countries to have a voice at the Security Council level on matters of international importance, among other things.
You mean permanent members with a veto?
Yes. There is a need for developing countries to also have a place on the United Nations Security Council. Yeah. As you know, there are only 5 permanent members. And to a large extent, sometimes decisions are made that are not in the best interest of other countries.
And who did she lobby on this matter? Did she talk to the heads of state of the countries that are permanent members?
Well, this was the speech she delivered at the opening of the General Assembly. She was like the fourth president after President Bush on the opening day. So she spoke prime time. Many of the other heads of state were there. And her speech, we also covered the need to improve the conditions of women around the world and to also help to sustain peace in other countries by ensuring that, you know, where there are areas of conflict, that the United Nations can move in and try to bring about some level of stability. So her speech was very well received by other countries that were represented at the opening session of the UN General Assembly.
My guest is Gabriel Williams, Assistant Minister for Information for the Government of Liberia. He's back home in Sacramento for a few days visiting his family. You sent me a couple of emails since you moved back to Liberia, which is your home country. It's where you were born. And one, there was a touching sentence at the end. You said, you wrote, "It is uplifting driving around Monrovia and seeing light poles and street lights being planted and installed after people have lived in darkness for over 15 years. Well, the darkness, I guess, is the unfortunate regimes of Liberia, but it seems like you're also talking about literal lightness.
Yes, very much so. As you may recall, for the past 15 years, in the wake of the civil war, all of the electrical means, pipe-borne water, and all of the infrastructure of the country were almost completely destroyed, to the extent that, for example, children that are 15 years or a little older than that in Liberia have not seen real electricity. So for the first time, there were streetlights. Indeed, there were lights to various hospitals and schools, and the government is now doing everything to expand the capacity of the electrical grid to include more neighborhoods. So for the first time, people were very happy that we are now having a new beginning in Liberia.
What's your job actually like? What's a typical day for you as Assistant Minister for Information in Liberia?
It's a very hectic one. I'm usually at work at 8:30 in the morning, between 8:30 and 8:15. On my way to work and at work, and in fact, when I'm home getting ready, I watch the CNN, I watch BBC News on television, and I follow the local stations, Liberian radio stations, television stations. And by the time I get to work, I review the various newspapers, and my minister gets in office, and I'm in his office to brief him on the developments of the day. And he moves on to brief the president on what's happening from the media aspect. And we also plan the media strategy for the day relative to how we're going to handle certain developments in the media in terms of getting back to the public. It's a very huge challenge.
Are you briefing the president on how the media is covering Liberia, or are you briefing the president on just what the media is saying about affairs of the world?
Everything. If it is local that affects if it is international that affects Liberia, we tell her. If it is, you know, especially local developments, it's important for the president to be adequately informed about what's happening locally, how people are reacting, how what they're saying, and so we try to, you know, make sure that we're on top of these developments by keeping her well informed. And she's very, very interested in what goes on in the street. Many times she will, you know, leave the executive mansion and just walk down the street where you will see children, women, marketers in the street, ordinary people come to her and, you know, they talk to her. She also has regular radio programs live where people can call in. As you may know, cell phone is all over Africa these days. So Many ordinary people call the radio stations and they get to ask the president questions and she answers their questions.
Doesn't she have guards who say, President Johnson Sirleaf, you shouldn't be walking around like that in the streets?
Well, she has security, our local security, and we have American Secret Service officers who are there. As you know, Liberia doesn't have its own security forces. The country is completely devastated as a result of the war. You have over 15,000 United Nations strong military force presence. You have international police force, more than 2,000. They are helping with the local police apparatus that has just been organized in addition to the reorganization of a new military. So the security of the country is pretty much in the hands of international people.
You said part of your job is devising the day's media strategy. Is that with the Liberian news media?
The both Liberian and international is our we are the spokesperson for the Republic of Liberia. When I speak on behalf of Liberia.
And what's the news media like in Liberia? Is it competitive?
Very competitive, mostly independent. We have dozens and dozens of FM radio stations across the country. We have, for example, a United Nations radio station that runs 24 hours, 7 days a week across Liberia and beyond. We have several other major newspapers, radio stations that are internationally run, in addition to local television stations and nearly 50 independent newspapers.
Are there any talk show hosts or newspapers, small newspapers that would like to see a return to the old days with Charles Taylor, for example?
Obviously, Mr. Taylor has his sympathizers. As you know,
really?
It's just been 3 years when he was in power. And, you know, with the money they looted from the country, many of his supporters are wealthy. I was just telling a friend while we were driving here that some of his people have their own radio stations. They have their own television stations. They have their own newspapers that enables them to propagate whatever cause they want to. And, of course, now Liberia is a free country and everyone has the right to express however opinion they have.
Does the president get advice from people who say she should shut down those papers and radio stations?
Even if such advice came about, she wouldn't take it because she is a very committed Democratic person. Liberia's sustainability now depends on making sure that we have in place a democratic system. And I will just go a little further. The Ministry of Information, of which I am the official now, has a statutory responsibility to monitor, to censor the media. But what we're doing right now under the new political dispensation is to go to the legislature to enact new laws that take away such powers from the ministry to ensure that the ministry is only there to devote all of the government's resources to promoting government programs and promoting unity and reconciliation. That's our goal right now.
Tell us what's happening right now with Charles Taylor, the former dictator. He fled to Nigeria, but then he was arrested when he was trying to get out of Nigeria because he's wanted for a war crimes trial. Where is he right now and what's happening?
Mr. Taylor was arrested in Nigeria. He was temporarily brought to Liberia. The Liberian government handed him over to the United Nations that actually wanted him. The United Nations indicted Mr. Taylor. It was not Liberia that indicted Taylor for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Mr. Taylor, having been handed over to the United Nations, he was temporarily detained in Sierra Leone, held in, incarcerated in Sierra Leone. Now he has been transported to The Hague, where he is in detention pending his trial, which begins next April.
Liberia has a historical connection to the United States from its founding. Where does Liberia's government stand on terror? Does President Johnson Sirleaf support President Bush on the war on terror, or is she critical?
In the president's address to the United Nations General Assembly, she actually indicated that that Liberia was strongly in favor of any effort that would be made globally to put an end to this global scourge, which is terrorism. And that Liberia is willing to provide all of its resources and every means. And you may probably not be aware that Liberia already is in partnership with the United States. For example, Liberia is a major maritime power in the world. A lot of people don't know that. Liberia has the flag of convenience. And as a result, majority of the many ships around the flag, around the world, rather, fly Liberia's flag of convenience. And the United States and Liberia has an agreement that will allow the U.S. Coast Guard to search ships flying Liberian flag. That's a major contribution to the fight on terrorism. And there's a law now in the Liberian legislature allowing the use of Liberian territory, making Liberia's territory disposable to the United States to be used in the fight against terrorism.
Also, in an email you sent me from Liberia, you talked about how you met President Clinton, and you talked with him about when you met him in Sacramento. Tell us about that. Why was President Clinton in Liberia?
Liberia now is actually becoming a global magnet. As we speak, the other billionaire, Robert Johnson, the founder of BET, mm-hmm. he's expected to go to Liberia pretty soon in the next few weeks, with an initial $30 million investment, in addition to Bill Gates, who's building 10 high-tech schools in Liberia. To come back specifically to the question, President Clinton was actually in Liberia to partner with the government in his global initiative organization that he has to help deal with the spread of AIDS and to help build Liberia's health network. And when he came back, when he came to Liberia, he had a town hall meeting with students, high school and college students, and he left so very impressed. He expressed that he was very impressed by the level of intelligence and just inquisitiveness of these young people and the need for Liberia to do everything to give these young people a future. He had a very wonderful time there. We also had the president of the World Bank, Paul Wolfowitz visited Liberia. He visited the ports and many other facilities. Liberia is a major, used to be a major, major industrial area.
How's your family doing? What do they make of, how are they dealing with your new job, your new schedule, your trans-global schedule?
It's just not so easy. We're all getting adjusted. It's a learning experience for all of us, and we're going through it. As we speak, I haven't really seen many of my family people yet, especially those that live outside the Liberian capital. I haven't been able to travel there because the past few months I've been in Monrovia is getting the ministry back up to speed, coordinating activities of the president, and a lot of work. I go to work around 8:30 in the morning. I'm now out of my office around 11, 12 midnight. So it's been very challenging.
But what about your family here?
They've been doing well. We've been in touch on a regular basis while I was on that side. This is why once I had the opportunity to come here, I'm spending the next few days with them where we're catching up on everything else. It's not so easy being away from your loved ones, but that's a sacrifice we have to make now for our country.
Is this the first time you've been back in Sacramento since you left in May?
Yes, this is the first time, even though I've been traveling to other places outside Liberia, but this is the first time back in the United States.
And when do you go back?
I am leaving next Thursday, actually, back for Liberia, en route to the East Coast and then back to Africa.
And any plans yet for your family here to move permanently to Liberia?
Well, I have.
Are you going to move permanently to Liberia?
We're working on that. I have my children in school, and it's not easy interrupting, you know, their studies, especially given the fact that, you know, Liberia is just everything is being put back into place. The schools are not yet up to speed. Health facilities are still being reconstructed. A lot of challenges that we have to deal with in the process of reconstruction. So it's just not advisable to uproot young children and carry them in such environment.
Sure, I can understand. Gabriel Williams is Assistant Minister for Information for the Government of Liberia. He's back home in Sacramento for a few days visiting his family. Gabriel, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a short run of the play Sex Talk this weekend in Sacramento. You'll meet the three actresses, one of whom is also the playwright. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A short play called Sex Talk is at Sacramento State this weekend, Friday and Saturday evenings. The playwright is Gaylika Brown, a Sacramento woman who recently graduated from Texas Southern University in Houston, where she studied theater. She wrote Sex Talk last year, and it premiered at a theater in Houston. The play features three women talking frankly about sex and relationship issues. Gaylika Brown is in the cast of the local production. She and fellow cast members Kelly Fields and Gianna Montoya join us. Gaylika, Kelly, Gianna, welcome to Insight.
Hello.
Hi.
Gaylika, it's a provocative title, Sex Talk. Why did you decide to call it that?
Well, the play is about sex, so I just planned on putting the whole title right out there and letting everyone know what it's about.
Why did you decide to write a play about sex?
Well, it's something that just came to mind, and one of the main reasons for me writing the show is to bring people into the theater, because the theater isn't as popular as it used to be. And I grew up on the stage, and to me it's kind of sad that a lot of people don't frequent the theater. And the people that do frequent the theater are the same bunch of people. So I decided to pick a topic that everyone could relate to and would spark some interest in people. And as we all know, sex sells. So figured I'd write my first show about sex.
Did anything inspire you with this? Did you model this on anything? Had you seen anything that gave you an idea?
No, not really. I honestly can't say why it just came to me. Just as a writer, sometimes things just come to me and I just write. And when I started writing it, I had no idea it was going to be a play. I just wrote the first monologue and I just kept going from there. And somewhere in the middle of it, I just started saving it on my laptop as Sex Talk, and I just kept that title. So, but I've never seen the Vagina Monologues, but it has been compared to that, and I figured I'd just write something that would spark a lot of interest and something that, if I was an audience member, I would enjoy watching.
Did you act in it when it premiered in Houston last year?
Yes. I played a different role, though. I actually played Woman 1, and in this production, I'm playing Woman 2.
Why did you change your part?
Well, the first time, one of my fellow students at my school directed it. So I told her, she pretty much casted who she thought was, you know, best for the part, and it just so happened that I was best for Woman 1. So for this production, I directed it, and I casted it. And I pretty much casted who I felt was best for Woman 1, Woman 2, and Woman 3.
And why did you not give the women names?
That's because I feel that I wrote each character as a certain type of woman. And I feel that every woman could relate to one of these characters. So I just decided to leave them nameless.
Gaylika Brown plays Woman 2 in Sex Talk, the play that she wrote. As I said, two of the cast members are also with us. Kelly Fields, you play Woman 1. Tell us who Woman 1 is. She doesn't have a name, but maybe you've given her a name.
Woman 1 is a very professional woman. She's always concerned about time. She only has a set amount of time to fall in love, to have kids. I mean, her clock, biological clock, is constantly ticking. So, Woman 1 does not have a name, but I like it as Woman 1.
Great. Well, we have a couple of excerpts from the play that we're going to do. And this one is mainly Woman 1, but it's also got Woman 2. Gaylika, just tell us anything we need to know before this starts, because it's kind of in progress.
Yeah, well, Woman 1's character, like she said, is very concerned with time. And she grew up with the, quote, perfect parents, unquote, as far as they were high school sweethearts and they got married and they're still married. And Woman 1 saw this growing up and wants this same type of relationship. So her main focus in life is to find someone and get married and have kids and have the same exact relationship that her parents have. And in this monologue, it pretty much describes, you know, how she's really wants this.
And in case any listeners are wondering, the Sex Talk does sometimes get quite frank about sex, but we've chosen scenes that should be okay.
Yes.
Okay, let's go.
I am tired of being alone. I have been dating since I was 15 and I am still single. The clock is ticking. I will admit I have had some very satisfying sexual expeditions, but none of them have led to marriage. It's hard to find the complete package. As a matter of fact, I don't think the complete package exists. Ever since my divorce at 18, I have been dating. I have met so many men, and there is always something wrong with one of them. Then, the ones that seem fine, I feel the need to find out if we're sexually compatible, and that can often be an intriguing phase. But if it doesn't work out in the end, all I end up with is a number on a list.
What list?
The sex list. With each failed relationship comes a name on the list. I don't want to be climbing up ladder 49 at the age of 29.
Screw a list. We're human beings. We're supposed to screw and reproduce.
This wasn't part of my plan. I'm supposed to be settled down with children right now. I wish Noah and I would have had a baby. I wish I would have never had that abortion, but Noah didn't want a baby. He always said that throughout high school, but I thought he'd grow out of it. Soon after we were married, he told me he wasn't in love with me anymore. I thought, if I were to get pregnant, he would stay with me and raise a family. I purposely got pregnant. I told my friends and family I was pregnant before I told Noah, and I was sure he would be happy about it, but he wasn't happy at all. He told me if I wanted him to stay with me, then I would have an abortion. To prove my love for him, I did. I told everyone I had a miscarriage. A couple months later, he divorced me. I put his wants in front of mine in exchange for the complete package, only to find out that he wasn't the complete package at all. That wasn't the only time I had an abortion. It was the first of four. After the first one, it was a breeze. And after the second one, I was out clubbing the next night looking for the complete package. Abortions are like birth control to me. What's the point of using condoms when you can have condomless sex, and if you happen to get pregnant, you can just have an abortion? I am trying to find the complete package, but there is no such thing as the complete package.
That's Kelly Fields playing the role of Woman One in Sex Talk. Kelly, what do you think about Woman One? Her attitudes.
She's a very complicated woman. But I like her attitudes overall, but I think she's a little too over-concerned with time and falling in love and finding the right person. She's just stuck in her parents' world. And
Gaylika, how do you write this?
How do I write this?
These are for the most part, a series of monologues.
Yes.
They're not characters interacting with each other for the most part.
Yes. Well, one of my favorite things, part of theater, are monologues. And I've written a series of monologues before I wrote Sex Talk. So my favorite thing to write are monologues. So I pretty much just started thinking of everything that has to deal with sex, as far as maybe abortions and or birth control or STDs, and just try to put my place in every single woman and just write from there. And for me, it's fairly easy to write monologues for me as opposed to dialogue back and forth.
Did you censor yourself at all when you're writing this? Because at times it does get quite frank. Did you ever think, I can't go there?
Yeah, well, of course I did think that. And if I would have wrote this 2 years ago, I wouldn't have written this anything like this. I wouldn't have been bold enough to do it. But I think I just pretty much reached that point in my life, and I was about to graduate from college, and I just felt like it was time for me to do something like this and forget about what people would think, what people would say. In the back of my head, I always had that. And yeah, it's going to be a little nerve-wracking doing it here in Sacramento, being that this is my hometown and my whole family is coming out.
Oh, yes.
So yeah, it was a little bit easier to do it in Houston, Texas.
And you're kind of wriggling around. Obviously, listeners can't see that. It's like you're anticipating.
Yeah, it's going to be fairly interesting, but I feel like these words are very important, and it's something that the world and the community needs to see.
Also with us is Gianna Montoya, who plays Woman 3, and we're going to hear an excerpt with Woman 3. Gianna, tell us about Woman 3. Who is she?
Woman 3 is, well, she's a school teacher, and she's a woman really in a lot of pain, I think. And she just really wants to find somebody. Like, her whole goal is not to be alone in life. And so basically she'll do anything that she can not to be alone.
And before we do it, Gaylika, tell us about Woman 2.
Woman 2 is, out of the three women, more blunt and hard. She has built walls up throughout her whole life. She grew up with parents who are still married, but she watched her father come and go out of her life because of adultery. So her whole take on men are that they're dogs, and she refuses to be played. So she has a very hard exterior.
Anything we need to know before this excerpt starts?
Well, yeah, this part, the excerpt that's about to come up is towards the end of the play. And this is when Woman 2 starts having a realization of who she now needs to become. And she's starting to break down her walls. And it leads into Woman 3 telling her monologue. And the monologues flow into each other. So you're going to get a piece of Woman 2, and it's just going to flow right into Woman 3.
Okay, well, let's hear it.
Woman 2, what do you want?
I want to play no games. I want to break down my walls. I want to feel. I want to feel pain and love. When I was a kid, my grandmother used to always ask me, "Baby, who do you love?" I used to always say, "You, Grandma." And she would smile and say, "That's nice, baby, but it's the wrong answer." Still to this day, my grandmother asks me that question, and I still answer it wrong. It is such a simple question. Who do you love?
I know love, and I know pain. When I first met Thomas, I knew we were going to spend the rest of our lives together. The way that he looked at me just told me so. We knew each other for a year. We dated 8 months and were engaged for 4 months. 2 months ago, we got married. And then 2 months into our marriage, Thomas got this new job with great benefits. He was going to be put on this new life insurance plan that would carry both of us. One of the stipulations was, you must get an AIDS test. That's when Thomas found out that he was HIV positive. Immediately, I knew that if he was, then so am I. It wasn't a yelling and screaming event. It just suffocated us emotionally. What do you feel? What do you think? What do you say when you find out that the one you gave your life to has given you a disease that may eventually take away your life? And what do you feel? What do you think? What do you say when they are just as much as an innocent bystander as you are? He didn't know he had this. He was in a 3-year relationship before he met me, and it wasn't until he confronted her on this current situation that he found out that she had been cheating on him throughout their entire relationship. She didn't know who she got it from, but she gave it to him, and he gave it to me. We could have gotten tested before we were married. We could have gotten tested before we had sex, but the reality of it is neither one of us were thinking about that. I've never wanted to die alone, so I stayed by his side.
Wow. Very powerful. Tell us how you feel about Woman 3, having heard a bit of Woman 3. Gianna?
She is just in a lot of pain, like I said. She just tried to do everything right in her life. She just tried so hard to give her love to people, and just everything kind of blew up in her face. Everything just came out really wrong for her, as you can see. She's the tragic character in the show, I would have to say.
There's a lot of sadness in this play, Gaelica.
It's mixed in. Because this is, you know, the radio, we can't put in all the humor because the humor comes in with the sex talk. But it is a mixture. I did try to do, you know, the serious side as well as the fun side. And we pretty much got a taste of the serious side here.
You got your bachelor's in performance theater, and you're planning to join a master's program.
But yes.
You haven't decided yet if it's going to be acting or writing. What's it going to take to tip you one way or another?
Well, I'm going to audition for both. At first, I was leaning more towards the acting, but now I'm really leaning more towards writing. And I think I'm going to audition for both and pretty much see what I get.
Was it the experience of writing Sex Talk that made you lean towards writing?
That and just wanting to be more well-rounded, because I do have my bachelor's in performance arts. So to be, you know, a little bit more rounded, if I received my master's in writing, you know, that would be great as well.
Well, Sex Talk is on Friday and Saturday evenings at 8 at the Hind Auditorium at Sacramento State. Best wishes, Gaelica Brown.
It is free.
That's always a good thing. And Kelly Fields and Gianna Montoya, thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
By the way, next week on Insight, we'll feature the Vagina Monologues, which is running in Sacramento. You'll hear a couple of excerpts and conversation with two of the actresses, including Amber Kloss. That's next Wednesday. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the author of Angry Black White Boy, novelist and journalist Adam Mansbach, is in town for a talk tonight at the Crocker Art Museum. We'll be right back. Come on. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow in Insight, you'll hear about a hazing incident in Chico and the bill it has inspired. Plus, a local musician performs live in our studio on an extended 25-string guitar, an instrument he invented. Tonight at the Crocker Art Museum, how hip-hop has influenced our society and culture. There's a panel discussion, including DJ Wayne Wayne of KSFM and Aaron Winters of Legend Magazine and American River College. Also on the panel is novelist, journalist, and hip-hop artist Adam Mansbach. He's perhaps best known for his novel Angry Black White Boy, the story of a suburban white boy filled with rage toward white America. Adam Mansbach is also founding editor of the 90s hip-hop journal Elementary. He's in our studio. Adam Mansbach, welcome to Inside.
Thank you.
What gave you the idea for your book, Angry Black White Boy?
Angry Black White Boy is really my attempt to grapple with the notion of white privilege in today's particular situation. It tells the story of a kid named Macon who is politicized and possessed by black culture and specifically hip-hop, and his rage toward the sort of complacency and hypocrisy of white people sort of boils over. And by the time he goes to New York City for college, he begins driving a cab and starts to rob white people who get in the cab and fling racial epithets at them. And he is able to get away with this for a couple of weeks because, quite simply, no one can connect what he is saying with his color. They can't mentally process the notion of a white kid committing these sort of racially motivated crimes against white people, so the word instead goes out that some militant black guy is robbing white people. So New York City is thrown into a panic, and he becomes sort of a celebrity and ends up calling for a day of apology on which white people are supposed to follow Malcolm X's tongue-in-cheek advice and apologize to black folks for 400 years of oppression, which doesn't go so well. So I wanted to approach the topic with a certain amount of satirical energy, a certain kind of absurdity in trying to galvanize what I consider to be a stalled discussion of race in America. I feel that white people particularly, we've retreated so far from an honest discussion, and this issue continues to cripple and divide us. So I really wanted to put forth these issues in a new kind of way, remix the American race novel, in a sense, and try to get some discussion going.
Racial conflict and divide in this country has been one of the most divisive issues and difficult issues to resolve in this country. Why did you choose humor as a way to discuss your thoughts on it?
I think it's fundamentally very difficult to get people to pay attention if you don't engage them, make them laugh, get them a little bit more comfortable. So I think this strategy has been used very successfully in race novels over the years, a certain kind of absurdity in books like Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison or Ishmael Reed's Flight to Canada, more recently The White Boy Shuffle by Paul Beatty, or even things like The Chappelle Show or The Boondocks TV show are grappling with race in some ways more profoundly than anything else we have in the popular media right now. And they're doing so because they are giving a nod to the absurdity of the situation. Race in itself, the way it's deployed, the way this construct continues to divide people is fundamentally absurd. And if it wasn't so horrifying, it would be amusing. So I think there's a certain logic to approaching it and exposing the absurdity of it.
What kind of neighborhood were you brought up in?
I grew up in a suburb of Boston called Newton, Massachusetts.
And who were your friends at school? Was it a racially, ethnically mixed place that you were brought up in or not?
I was brought up in a community that was probably about 60% Jewish. But the key thing about my schools, I went to public schools throughout my youth. As a result of the busing battles that were fought in Boston, and which only ended in the early 70s, the schools were integrated through a busing program that brought inner-city kids out to the suburbs, sort of a unidirectional form of integration, you might say. So my friends were very diverse. I was hanging out with local Jewish kids from Newton like myself, but also with black kids from Mattapan and Roxbury. And as my interest in hip-hop started to flourish, which was really at the age of like 10 or 11, I started to get into the music. I started to spend more time with those kids because they knew about it, and also to spend more time in their neighborhoods searching out the music and searching out the parties and all of the other accoutrements of the culture.
Did those kids accept you?
Well, they were my friends, so, certainly. It's funny because it's hard to explain to people what hip-hop was like back then. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, but it was before hip-hop hit the cultural mainstream. So it was really something you had to seek out of your own volition. It wasn't being streamed into your home 24/7 on TV, radio, and the internet. So you had to seek it out. And there was a certain process of doing so that was going to engage you in a way that was very sincere and fundamental. So just by nature of being a hip-hopper, somebody who was seeking out this music, you had almost a ready-made network. If you met another person into hip-hop at that point in time, it was a big deal because there weren't many of us. So in that sense, yes, I did find acceptance. But also, there's a pathology, I think, for white kids getting into hip hop, at least at that time. And a lot of it had to do with redefining yourself away from a traditional notion of whiteness and associating instead with something that was oppositional to the dominant culture. So I was very invested, not in fitting in and passing, but first, before I was granted that, being challenged and getting to prove myself. And I did this over and over. You know, this was something that was about self-gratification on one level. Going to a party, being singled out as the only white kid there, being asked why I was there, and then explaining through the fact that I was an MC, so I might be asked to kick a rhyme, and I was good enough to be appreciated for that, particularly since the standards for white people rhyming at that point were extremely low. So, you know, I might have been getting more credit than I deserved. But there was this process of inviting a challenge, meeting the challenge, getting acceptance that allowed me over and over again to feel like I was moving away from this notion of whiteness that I found to be oppressive. White privilege economically and institutionally was something I was really trying to be critical of. And hip hop was a forum for me to be critical of it.
How did you learn how to kick a rhyme?
Well, I come from a long line of literary people. My grandmother was a poet. And, you know, just like everybody else, I taught myself. I listened to recordings ad nauseum. In the early 80s, you know, this was Run DMC, this was LL Cool J and Cool Moe Dee and Grandmaster Caz on old Cold Crush tapes that I had to bargain with people to get because they were coming out in New York and they were very limited in quantity. And I had a literary bent, which is why I turned out to be a writer. So learning how to rhyme was just a matter of being studious.
Did the kids who you were joining, mainly black kids, I guess, who were into hip-hop too, did they say, hey, Adam, it's okay, you're into hip-hop, but you can't really know and you can't really get involved with our lives because our lives in the inner city is so different from your life as a white Jewish kid in the suburbs?
There was a lot of interplay between those two norms. And what kids do when they interact in those ways is find the advantages that each one can bring to the other's life. So I never made any presumption to have some kind of perfect platonic understanding of anybody's life, and I still don't. But you find ways to make prejudice and racism work for you. In other words, I was the one who stole the cans of paint because I was the only one in the store that wasn't being followed by the security. And consequently, the black kids were the ones who bought the beer in the suburbs when we were hanging out in my neighborhood because very few white adults could tell how old they were. So there was a way in which a certain kind of consciousness of societal tropes and issues was being used to the advantage of me and my crew of friends. And this is not an isolated thing. I mean, this is the way it functions all over the place,
sure.
Right?
My guest is Adam Mansbach. He's author of Angry Black White Boy. He's a novelist, journalist, and hip-hop artist. This evening, he speaks in a panel discussion about hip-hop culture at the Crocker Art Museum. What do you think about rap today? There's a lot of, obviously not all of it, but some of it is misogynist, homophobic, there's violence, and so on in it. What do you think about that part of rap?
To me, the biggest thing that saddens me about the direction rap and hip-hop has taken on that kind of a mainstream level that you're describing, which I agree can often be misogynistic, homophobic, above all else perhaps materialistic to an almost psychotic degree, obsessed with acquisition. If you are a young kid today coming up as a casual listener of hip-hop, which of course it's very easy to be because it's all around you, you would have no awareness of hip-hop's true roots in social resistance to oppression, in a kind of community voice springing from the margins and speaking truth to power. Fundamentally, hip-hop in its original sort of uncut pure state was about a forging of community and incredibly ingenious responses to the ways that particularly the city government of New York had silenced young people of color. So it depresses me to see the direction it's taken, and even the direction it's taken since the late 80s when I really started to see the hip-hop nation, as we called it then, surging unstoppably forward, mounting incredibly ingenious critiques of the educational system and police profiling and harassment. We've really moved a long way, and the pendulum has really swung away from that kind of overt consciousness into something else. So I'm very critical of the trends that you outlined. But of course, hip-hop is also so huge now and so prolific that there are any number of simultaneous strains going on. So on an underground level, there is still good work being done that is attempting to counter these misogynistic strains. On a global level, too, you know, hip hop has really infiltrated communities worldwide. And in some ways, some of the best work is happening outside of this country. And in some ways, some of the best work is happening in this country outside of traditional hip hop vectors. So I don't look necessarily to rap music or to breakdancing or b-boying or to the aerosol art movement for my inspiration as much as I look to what I consider sort of second generation hip hop art forms. That is to say, people who are inspired by the aesthetics of hip hop but are working in fiction or journalism or film or activism or education.
What happened? What caused that change in hip hop from the type of music and culture that it was in the late 80s that you described into the dominant form of rap today?
I think that in a lot of ways what happened was the pendulum swung away from consciousness and certain artists sold a ton of records and really changed the stakes of the game. Around 1988 to 90, at the same time that groups like Public Enemy, Boogie Down Productions, and the Jungle Brothers and X-Clan and Brand Nubian were doing this sort of vanguard political stuff, you also had the rise of groups like NWA, who were incredibly political too, but also outsold probably all those groups combined and were labeled as a so-called gangster group. And in the aftermath of their success, the industry scrambled to sign other such groups. So by 1991, you had this incredible profusion of groups that were articulating a much more nihilistic and, you know, sometimes violent worldview, and that started to sell. And then hip-hop hit the pop charts around the same time with people like MC Hammer and Young MC and Vanilla Ice around 1990 also started to chart majorly. And suddenly selling 300,000 units or 200,000 units was not good enough. That would have gotten you a second album in 1988 or 89 or even 90. But 4 years later, after the Chronic Dr. Dre's album came out and after NWA's second album came out, that simply wasn't good enough. So there was an enormous industry move and an investment of capital that pushed rap and hip-hop to another level of sort of sales dominance and mainstream dominance, and it started to infiltrate television in a different kind of way, and rappers started to cross over and become movie stars, from Ice Cube to Will Smith to Queen Latifah, and suddenly this was an interface with capitalism that was just enormous, and the impetus to be political and maintain a certain underground presence but also have, you know, this coded message thing going on became a lot harder to maintain.
Do you think hip-hop still has the creative energy to sustain it for years to come?
Absolutely. I think that a hip-hop mind state is an incredibly resilient and swiftly evolving one. So hip-hop is forever growing and changing, and the mentality of it is very resourceful, very democratic in its source materials. So I think what we view as hip-hop in its raw essence is going to continue to be provocative and interesting, whether that is manifesting in music or whether it's manifesting in activism, strategies for education, strategies for fiction writing or theater remains to be seen, but certainly it's not going anywhere.
And we just have about a minute left, Adam. Your next novel has also has a provocative title, The End of the Jews. What can you tell us about that?
The End of the Jews comes out next September, and it's a multi-generational story about a Jewish family that spans most of the 20th century and grapples with the 50-year dissolution of a marriage, the kind of intersection between ambition and betrayal. There's a hip-hop narrative embedded in there. A lot of it deals with the way this family of Jewish artists has intersected with black artists from sort of the age of jazz to the age of hip-hop. It's a big, sprawling 500-page novel that I haven't quite figured out how to summarize yet, but I'm very happy with it, and I'm glad that it's coming out.
So you know already that it's a 500-page novel?
It's around there, yeah. I mean, the publisher...
Because that's what it is now, and you're just working with that?
Just based on the sort of word count, it's not going to be possible to publish it at much less than 400 pages. You know, the publishers have a certain leeway. I mean, they can publish it a little shorter, a little longer, but it's going to be pretty long. It's being published by Doubleday Books and actually a new imprint of Doubleday called Spiegel & Grau. And it'll be actually one of the first books published by that imprint. So that's kind of exciting.
Adam Mansbach, author of Angry Black White Boy, novelist, journalist, and hip-hop artist. This evening, he's speaking in a panel discussion about hip-hop culture at the Crocker Art Museum. There's a link to more information on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, information about the panel, but also a link to Adam Mansbach's website. Adam, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, thoughts about war from U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's an anthology of the letters, emails, and essays, that story, and the day's news next on The World. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thanks to our associate producer Rob Whitlock, and thank you for joining us.
Should California join a compact of states whose electoral votes would go to the winner of the popular vote in presidential elections? Find out next time on Insight. Also, hear about a Chico hazing incident and the bill it has inspired. Plus, a local musician performs live on a 25-string classical guitar, an instrument he invented. I'm Douglas Everett. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.